when all you have is a search engine, everything looks like a database.
Man, I have like a cypherpunk hard on right now.
Privacy is nothing to be granted. Privacy is something you take yourself.
And they've got the Mossad, the CIA, and Hillary Clinton behind them.
We're now beyond what the Stasi could even dream of.
Reality Exploit Roundtable.
Welcome back, Reality Exploiters, to Reality Exploit Roundtable, episode number 18, March 1st, 2013. Today on the show, we have Voodoo, Smuggler, Plato, and Wise Guy. Hey, guys.
Yo.
Hey, Hero.
How you doing?
Hey there.
Great. Just a little show note before we get going. Smuggler has posted up a mirror for the Reality Exploit Roundtables. We'll add that into the show notes that you can reach over on the Anarplex websites. And with that, we will roll right into our first topic, number one, with Smuggler. From an article with Wired, anti-drone fashions. Smuggler, in an article, we've read articles on rulescaping on Anarplex. And as the eyes in the sky breed, do you think we'll develop new social conventions to maintain our privacy? There's lots of locations we can't wear masks. And will there be locations where it's taboo to show your face?
Well, I do think that new social conventions will come into reality, and they are already. I mean, it's quite normal for certain situations that you ask people to leave their cell phone at home or not bring their camera or stuff like that. So we kind of already have privacy maintaining conventions. However, I don't think they'll be there collectively. I think there will always be a majority of people that give a shit about their privacy, because a privacy really only makes any sense for an individual, and most people today seem to have given up on that. And I don't think that there's too many locations where you cannot wear a mask. I run around with a mask quite frequently, and except for banks and government buildings, I never had a big issue with that. Well, airports doesn't fly well there. So I do think that there will be some spots, like privacy spots, where if you're coming there without a mask and with your cell phone and with a camera, you might have some issues, because with privacy for all the other participants, the enforcement could be a little bit rough.
Yeah, you'd be looking like the narc.
I guess that's going to be a group of individuals, though, who have collectively decided, well, we want to maintain our privacy and we'd prefer to keep cameras and cell phones out of our mind. And Smuggler, you were saying before that that's just not the mindset of many people. I think you're right. I think there's a lot of people who are, I guess, subscribing to the idea that collectively as a society, there's no privacy available for anyone. And why should I bother trying to make it for myself?
You know, I think right. That there is a subset, there is a kind of, you could call, subculture or a subset of modern culture which does already kind of abide by something like this, and that's some of the Hollywood type like celebrities. A lot of these people really don't like the idea of people walking around and taking all kinds of personal pictures with them that wind up on the covers of magazines and the like. So in some of those circles, I've heard of some of it really not being a cool thing, people walking around taking pictures in some of these like elite type situations.
Right, but you're talking about the subset of what, 200 people in America there?
Yeah,
I think there's a much larger subset. I mean, if you look at, you know, rocker gangs or outlaw motorcycle gangs or cypherpunks and so on and so on, I think those subsets are far larger. But you usually don't hear about any of those subsets in media. The thing actually is that, at least judging from my own social environment, I come from a city where people running around with cell phones and cameras all the time and taking pictures of everything is quite normal. And what happens here increasingly is that people that take pictures without asking the people they're shooting, that those people are confronted and sometimes even violently. So there's something brewing, and I wonder where that might go. Maybe we will have something like privacy extremists or privacy punks pretty soon, and I'm all for it.
Well,
we've touched on it before, but at least when the guy's flashing the cell phone in your face, you know about it. But it may not, the average person on the street may not be aware that there's, you know, a million drones in the sky that are able to read his wristwatch.
Well, CCTV cameras are the biggest issue for most people right now. There are not that many drones, but a lot of CCTV cameras. And what people already do is stuff like Camover, where they're attacking public CCTV and smash cameras. Or there are other people, at least in the city I'm from, it happens quite a lot over the last few weeks, actually. I noticed it a couple of times where I saw people that I didn't really know that were wearing bandanas or whatever in front of their face, not just because of the cold, but because they were pissed off of all the surveillance.
Well, that's a good thing, actually. The area where I live, there's lots of Oriental people, and many of them, especially in the summer, wear full-face sunscreens. And those are not considered masks, and I've never seen them bothered by the police. So it would seem that that's, if people were to wear generic clothing, like some kind of caped dress, and all in the same color, and they were wearing these headdresses, it could become very difficult to notice who's whom, especially if they were willing to, for instance, put a tack in their shoe so as to change their cadence. That makes it very difficult to do that kind of analysis about your walking either.
I think I'd rather have a little electrode or something. The tack,
The tack is a very common thing, by the way, that's used when you're being forced to take a lie detector test. What it does is it raises the stress level in your body and makes it impossible to find the norm.
That's great. Real quick, back to the anti-drone camouflage apparel article. Smuggler, is there anything or the rest of you that you'd like to comment on about some of the trade craft that some of these people are that's being mentioned about in this specific article?
Well, yeah, I'd like to comment on a few things. Number one is it's a piece of a larger movement already. There's quite a lot of anti-surveillance gear coming out over the last few months, starting with special glasses that you wear to foil face detection and stuff like that. I think that most of the things that are out there are not yet practical, widely available, and all that. But I actually think there's a business opportunity there. And I also think that a lot of those things that are exploited right now, be it metallized clothing, be it infrared lights, and so on, they will go through an evolution, and we will see what really works best and integrate them into a good fashionista style clothing.
Yeah, I'd like to see how the market in these things develops. Adam Harvey, the guy in the article, he's an artist and he's making these as artistic pieces. I don't know what it costs to make them yourself if you want to have your own copies, but it's probably fairly expensive with the materials and stuff. Smuggler, maybe you have some advice on fashions for the thrifty.
Well, there are actually quite a few things. Number one is the baseball cap combination with a hoodie works pretty well. Most of the time, we are not up against infrared cameras that essentially scan us from the skies, but we're up against CCTV, which do a little bit of infrared spectrum, but they're not. The infrared is not really wide enough to see through your clothes. So that is number one. So the standard hoodie with a baseball cap, sunglasses. There are some very wide sunglasses. I'll put a link into the show notes for a sunglass design that we have tested and that works really well against face detection. And the other thing that you should really think about, and that is something that we do over here quite a lot, is have a radiation-tight pocket for your cell phone that is openly available on the market. You can get that anywhere. So you put your cell phone in and it won't be able to communicate with the cell phone network and get a pager instead, which is available in most bigger countries. You can get pagers still and you'll be reachable, but you'll not be trackable.
Oh, that's great.
It looks like one of the things Adam Harvey is selling is his off-pocket, which looks to be just that. It's a pouch that you put your phone in that appears to be a radiation shield. And he's asking £100 British for that.
You can get that for like $10.
You can get it for a lot less than that. Electronic components are shipped in Ziploc metalized bags, and you could just stick one in your pocket.
Yeah, that's true, but they have an issue with sweat. I tried that once, and it didn't work well for my skin.
Are you talking about the Mylar bags that chips come in?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're great for that.
That blocks RF?
Oh, absolutely. They're metalized.
Very cool.
But as Smuggler said, that they also don't breathe very well. So if in your pocket for a long time against or near your skin, well, I guess if you slipped it inside another pocket, well, even then it would be a problem. But one more thing I wanted to mention. So I don't understand why someone hasn't come up with inexpensive metalized clothing, sort of like underwear or outerwear for the people in the hood. Those are the people who are most at risk. They get tasered all the time. Metalized clothing neutralizes tasers. So I really can't understand why some person hasn't gone to a manufacturer in Japan, well, not Japan, but in China, and said, look, you guys in this other area of the garment industry are manufacturing metalized clothing, mostly for women. They use metalized clothing in order to provide these sparkly, iridescent type of garments. Well, those could easily be woven into underwear or outerwear, and you can also make caps out of them that would prevent you from being, hit in the head with a taser.
Well, I'm very sorry to say that, but there actually exists metal mesh underwear, or actually it's not so much thought as being the lowest level layer on your body, but you essentially it's like an undershirt or something like that. I have one right here, and it's pretty good actually against tasers. We tested that several times, but you cannot wear it directly on the skin.
You guys did taser testing.
It's uncomfortable.
You guys did taser testing wearing metal underwear?
Yeah, sure.
Right, yeah, you can't have underwear because the metalized fabric is pretty coarse and it's uncomfortable to be against your skin.
Yeah, it's like just a funny image.
It really is. I'm picturing Smuggler lumbering towards an aggressor with like 6 taser darts trailing out of him.
Smuggler, how much did it cost for that outerwear?
Yeah, wearing nothing. 20, wearing nothing.
$25.
Wearing nothing.
See, that's what things should cost.
He's wearing nothing but a metal jockstrap. I mean, it's like, what in the world?
You need to post where you got that.
Yeah,
if it's available online.
It is.
Real quick, before we move on to the next topic, back to the camover stuff. I heard one reporter was asking one of the camover guys was destroying some of these cameras. He was saying, don't you think it's a waste of taxpayers' money to be destroying these cameras? And the guy quickly responded back to him, don't you think that's a waste of taxpayers' money for them to continue to keep installing these things?
point made.
Yeah. And then one other thing, I saw on the camover, one of the things that a lot of these guys were doing was not just like ripping these cameras down and destroying them, but a lot of them were just doing spray paint over the lenses or the little glass compartments. And it doesn't destroy it, but it makes it, it's a mess and they have to replace the glass or whatever, all this stuff. But I can see in the future coming like hordes of drones with paintball guns on them or something, just like, flying through the city, knocking out paintballs, just disabling the lenses on roadside cameras and all over the place without anyone having any idea where the drone came from and where it went.
Well, I do want to say that all of this entire discussion kind of goes against something Smuggler said on a very early Reality Exploit Roundtable, which is this is all an arms race where you make the clothing and then they make the better camera and then the better facial detection and then you got different makeup. And I'm just waiting for the nanobot screen from the Diamond Age.
Well, if you look at military technology of, you know, measures and countermeasures, what you find is that the person who comes up with the countermeasure, the countermeasure turns out to be exorbitantly more difficult and expensive than the person who had the countermeasure. So I think that if you raise the bar, even as far as what you can do with simple technology, the countermeasure sometimes becomes almost impossible to implement on a wide scale basis.
All right, good stuff, guys. Let's move on to the next topic with Plato. Government to team up with industry to fight online radicalization in the U.S. from an article in Alternet. What could go wrong? White House to partner with big business to combat online, quote, online radicalization. What kind of language is this? From the article, perhaps the most alarming aspect of the White House plan to counter online radicalization is this plan to work with industry to do so. The federal government will collaborate with industry to explore how we might counter online violent extremism while protecting lawful internet use and the civil liberties and privacy of individual users, according to the White House. Now, I have one question for you, Plato. What is online violent extremism? I don't understand exactly necessarily what online violent extremism is. And what do you think the consequences of Verizon teams up with the government to combat this so-called online radicalization?
Well, you know, I'm not quite sure exactly what they mean by online radicalization. And I don't think they actually gave a definition, which is it's the same thing that the White House always says. They just make all their statements as vague as possible so they can apply them to whatever they want. Online radicalization could be anything up to and including, I don't know, sharing links to ronpaul.com. If they deem Ron Paul to be an enemy of the state, you may be supporting terrorism by telling other people about this terrorist site. You know, that's an extreme example, but it's a slippery slope because they can start by saying, oh yeah, it's only the Al-Qaeda websites and we're not going to, you know, curtail your liberties or anything. We just want to make sure that we can know who's accessing the Al-Qaeda sites. But who knows where it's going to go from there. I mean, if you look at the language of NDAA, that's super vague too. And you don't have to actually, you know, be a terrorist. I think the language is material support. So I don't know. That could be something that you could view an ad on a website that's determined to be a terrorist website and bam, that's material aiding of terrorism. And you're now eligible to be thrown in Gitmo. So I don't know where it could go from there, but I don't think it's good. And as far as consequences of Verizon and other ISPs collaborating, well, we've seen it a couple times already. Look at the warrantless wiretapping that was super illegal, and none of the ISPs cared. They all caved and threw in these closets with beam splitters so the government can get copies of all the content that's flowing across the networks. I mean, they did that already, and you know, they throw out millions of cell phone records, as we've covered in a previous episode. I don't think there's going to be any limitation to the data that the ISPs are going to be willing to share with the government, so they're going to see everything that you're doing.
I agree. The ISPs will roll over and do whatever the White House wants, but I think it's probably good to recognize right now that this is a White House that has declared itself the unilateral ability to put U.S. citizens on a list. And it shouldn't matter whether it says U.S. citizens or not, but it's said they can put U.S. citizens on a list, and due process is us putting you on the list, and we can kill your ass. So I don't think they're too worried about online free speech. So basically anybody who's critical of the White House, if you look just this last weekend, the White House went after Bob Woodward of all people, and they went ruthlessly against Bob Woodward what damage to his reputation remains to be seen, but they do not like criticism, and that's exactly who they're talking about, people who criticize this administration.
Voodoo, what was he criticizing? Just real quick.
Bob Woodward tracked down the root of the sequestration, and of course, the Obama White House are the ones that came up with this sequestration shenanigans in the first place. But Bob Woodward having the tenacity to say so, even though, you know, the White House has been denying it for the last couple of months, that put him square in the crosshairs of a lot of people, not just in the White House, but also the most notable liberals in the media.
Wise guy.
Well, I was going to say that even though the major press continues to sort of play along with the administration as far as the sequestration being considered some kind of real cliff that the economy is going to go over, a lot of people have analyzed the numbers and said this is just fear mongering, and you know that the administration really what's going to happen is when these measures actually go into place, in the sense that they actually start to bite, and the jobs get cut, or the amounts of money and budgets get cut, and they have to deal with it. Each one of the administration's sections, when nothing happens 3 or 6 months from now, many people are going to remember, though the press won't cover it, the major press, because that's considered impolitic, that it was all basically fear mongering, and then people are going to look at each other in Washington and say, oh. Well, this worked. Maybe we can do this even further. And that's what is scaring the hell out of the administration, is that they are not able to stop it before it takes place and nothing happens. It's sort of like a thump, you know, politically and economically. Then people will feel emboldened to to propose even more cuts to the federal deficit or the federal government's budgets.
Or maybe even just one actual cut.
I was going to say the sequestration actually isn't much of a cut at all. It's just actually a tax future spending increases.
I just wanted to come back to the original topic of government and business cooperating on anti-radicalization and stuff like that on the internet. I think the big issue here is not so much that the ISPs will hand over data to the government, but I think the biggest issue is that this could be a venue for the government to get DPI systems into ISP networks and essentially go from there. So that is the door opener for the cooperation between big government and the ISPs is to implement DPI on a national scale here.
I think there's another aspect to this these terms online radicalization and online violent extremism. That is another wedge in here, and that's hate speech, that they start to talk about violent hate speech geared toward, you know, Jews or something like that. And then that gets thrown into this whole thing about bullying. That's also a big thing in a lot of states in the U.S. right now, where it's illegal to actually insult somebody in some cities and states in certain ways. So that also is another angle that they'll throw in here to then have they're just looking for these extreme people because of their language and stuff like that. So
yeah, don't forget real name also. Get rid of any sort of anonymity.
Yes, like Facebook is implemented.
Or Google.
And Google.
Well, actually still do the stuff in Google without having real names, but it's you have to go through a little more of a difficulty.
You know, this is kind of a tangent, but I don't think having a system for providing real names and real identity to link, you know, online handles to real people, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, depending on how it's used. I'm imagining, you know, some jurisdiction has a government that provides services to some group of people, and they're keeping track of their people through, you know, some art keys or something. But if they can associate individual keys to individual people, then they can be sure that they're only providing services to, you know, X people. And maybe they have some voting system, they can use that to prevent people from making many handles and voting multiple times.
Well, that is something on the application or service level, but it's not on the network level. So it's a whole different thing. My fear is that people are trying to make all this shit part of the internet ecosystem, and not just part, but integral part of the internet ecosystem.
I think this announcement of, you know, them looking to somehow close the loophole on radicalization is the kind of trial balloon that's sent up often in government. What they're looking for is to see how much pushback they get. If there's not much pushback, then they'll go ahead and start writing laws and looking to implement these things. If there's a lot of pushback, then they'll back off for a while before they go ahead.
Yeah, it's a test balloon to get people used to it.
Yeah, I guess the mandatory one where everyone is required to participate, and it allows the ISPs to track you.
Yeah, where it turns into a passport where you can't even do anything on the internet without it being tied to your DNA. Let's move on to the next topic with Voodoo here. There's an article here on Scientific American, Why It's Smart to Be Reckless on Wall Street. This article outlines a few strategies that traders use to get rich. The basic strategy is to place bets with big bets with company money, and the worst case scenario, you lose nothing. Voodoo, in a well-functioning market, the unfit traders are supposed to lose all their money, so they drop out of the market. Apparently, individual Wall Street traders can just profit with the firm's money. How on earth do they stay in business?
That is the number one question that this editorial brings to mind, this Chris Arnand at Scientific American. You know, if you can continuously lose money, you know, what he's saying is the incentives are built into the pay structure where you bet big, because if you win big, you get bonuses. If not, you get your base salary and you don't have to pay back any of the money that you lost. And that those are perverse incentives to be reckless with other people's money. Well, look, you can only be reckless with other people's money for so long before you run out of other people's money. And so that either says that there's a backstop, which we know there is, you know, with too big to fail, or that they, you know, somehow that information is not getting out to the investors, to the individual investors, that, hey, this, you know, firm A or this investment bank is making huge bets with your money and in a lot of cases betting against your money. But what's interesting is Arnand likened this to sports teams, which I thought was really interesting. Says, you know, the only other perverse incentives like this, or the analogy would be a professional athlete, where they are encouraged to, you know, go as hard as they can and do superhuman feats. And if you ruin your body in the process, oh well. And the worst that can happen is you lose. And so the people who bought tickets to the game and didn't see you win, they're the only losers. What he's missing there is that these professional sports teams are spending a lot of taxpayer dollars on these on the stadiums and the ballparks and everything, and of course the big projections that it's going to pay back, and no one's going to ever, you know, the revenues from the ancillary services will pay back these bonds. That never happens. The taxpayers always get put on the hook for these bonds. But what's really interesting is this Arnand said, you know, is saying, oh, the banks are so much more important than the teams. Well, it's funny because I never see people, you know, chanting Citibank, Citibank, and saying we won whenever, you know, Citibank wins big. And yet they have that sort of relationship with the local sports teams, with the local, you know, professional sports teams. And so I'm not too sure that Arnand's right, that the banks are more important. If it was so important, then people would be choosing sides, I think, more than they are, and it would be more of an issue. But as long as there's the backstop there, as long as the government, or as long as taxpayers are going to be on the hook for any losses, there's the real perverse incentive is that there's no one who's willing to take a stand to do something about it.
The people are shouting for their sports teams because the sports teams are all stars and everybody loves them. And the people may not be doing that for Citibank, but the regulators certainly are. Everybody in government who is in charge of, you know, regulating the banks and keeping the economy going and all that, they love Wall Street because, you know, it provides economic growth. There's more dollars in the system and we can put out big GDP numbers and everybody loves it.
Yeah, that's true. The opposite, the other side of the yelling for the team is the USA, USA, we're the greatest, we're the greatest at all. And Bernanke slams down a home run with another QE.
What I found interesting about the article is the scenario that it might be possible, even practical, for two people to collude, like some young traders on the in Wall Street, because he notes that when a person gambles very big, he either wins big and gets a huge amount of bonus, or he loses big and is either gets no bonus, or in the worst case gets dismissed from the job. If he gets dismissed from the job, often on Wall Street, when you're known to be a big risk taker, many people will hire you on because they'll figure, okay, well, he lost on this one, but maybe the idea was good. It just went against him. So you can work at the next company and the next. And some people have been through three and four firms, even though they've lost big at them. What that opens up in the article is that two people can collude so that they'll each bet on the same type of bet, but on opposite sides. And the one that wins big, he gets a huge bonus. The one that loses either keeps his job and has no bonus or little bonus, or he's dismissed. But in either case, the two people split the bonus so that they can continue to bet both sides, and it doesn't matter which one of them wins, as long as one of them wins, which almost always one will. So they can continue to make huge amounts of money, which huge losses going to whoever's, you know, whichever one of the traders has lost their bet.
Wow, what a scam.
Well, and there's actually a one-person scam that works that same way, but you see it more in the touts that are selling tips for betting. What they'll do is the half of the clients that are paying them, they'll say, bet on the Ravens. And then the other half, they'll say, bet on the Patriots. And then so they make half of that client base happy. Whoever, you know, whoever wins, it doesn't really matter. Half that client base is happy. They come back the next week and pay for the next week pick, do the same thing. And it, you know, if you have enough people in that first pool, you make money all the way through, even though you've never made a real prediction. And you can do that same thing on Wall Street. Although the SEC, you know, if the SEC catches you, you're pretty well screwed.
Yeah, that is actually a scam that's used with, a lot of newsletters have done that in the past, where they would predict the certain things to happen in the stock market or some other market, and they would have a large mailing list of 1 million people, and they would send out a free newsletter, and half of them they'd predict one way and half the other way, and then and they would repeat that same thing continually, and people would be buying their newsletters and sending them money and all this, and they could, like you said, if you have a large enough group, then you can keep on doing that all the way down until, you know, you're in your to their, where they really think that you know it all, and that's when they give you the big money and you walk away.
That's when you become Wayne Allen Root and become the vice presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party.
Oh, real quick on this topic, I mean, we made some commentary about it, but I mean, is there any type of structural things that can be done to change any type of things in this system besides saying we need to have more laws to keep these guys from doing this or that?
I think it's going to be really hard until you can remove the government backstop, because there's no incentive to place sound bets if these firms are confident that they're going to get money from the taxpayers and or, you know, Uncle Sam's credit card.
Right.
So. Yep, that's exactly right. So you can add all the regulations you want. If you don't get rid of the backstop, you haven't done a darn thing except make the system as make it inflexible so that if major shifts do occur in the marketplace and new products appear, they're not going to be able to invest in those the way they should be. And so it's just distortions all the way down. You have to get rid of that backstop.
Yeah, I bet what they'll try is just adding more paperwork and, you know, oh, you have to be a little bit more descriptive when you account for all your trades and stuff like that. You know, bureaucrats make more work for other bureaucrats.
Which is tough to do with high-frequency trading because you'd have to do documentation on millions of trades a second.
Yeah, well, having this conversation similar to this the other day, someone was talking about the U.S. military. And like, you know, what can stop the U.S. military empire and expansion and all this other stuff. And it's like, when it comes down to it, they'll stop it when they can't afford it anymore. And the same thing with a lot of this stuff is when these perverse incentives are no longer part of the national budget, then some of these problems just magically go away.
Yeah, the worst part, as I see it, is that the state doesn't take into account the non-monetary costs Like, it's as far as I can tell, anyway, it's just not on their balance sheet that by occupying all these foreign countries, you're building up a ton of ill will, and people aren't going to trade with you. They may even try and, you know, bomb you or whatever. And that's a cost that, in a real market, that would be taken into account. People would be careful to, you know, not anger their trading partners and stuff like that. But we don't see any, you know, rational thinking with that variable.
I think recently Bernanke was asked about this risk-taking and the fact that the major the money center banks in the United States can borrow much cheaper than the other banks, the medium, you know, scale banks. And because it's only the large banks that are sort of too big to fail, the system is guaranteed to cause more and more concentration of money and wealth and power in the few largest bank firms in on Wall Street. And he was asked how they intend to do something about this, and he stammered and had no answer.
I think that one needs to keep in mind that the government is in on that game for 100% because they want to be in on that game. The government wants the big banks work like they do because that provides the government with, number one, a reason to be there, and number two, with income not from the banks but from the other slaves. So I think that if you really create backstops on those high risk things, then you might actually reduce the visible profit for the single investor, which will be your mom and dad. Your mom and dad will complain about the high inflation and no return on their portfolio. They come to the government and say, you screw, and maybe shoot the president or whatever they do. And then the government is over with. So essentially, it's just a scheme to drag it on and drag it on and make sure that the slaves that you remember die before the system blows up.
Thanks, Smuggler. Wise guy, voodoo play on all those things. All right, we're going to move in here to our next topic, and we'll take a break here for a second. Wise guy, did you have something that you wanted to cover?
Plugs?
Yeah, I'll do plugs. Wise guy. Just real quick so I can
prepare him on my... plugs immediately so that Plato can go.
Yeah, my roommate's not here yet. I'm not leaving immediately, but I could be leaving at any time. So I would say we should do plugs now.
Okay, I'll do plugs, but I want to have this rocking in my head. Wise guy, what's the topic?
Well, I had two there. I was thinking of just doing something about that came from Matonis's Monetary Future about anonymity and currency, the cashless society being a utopia.
Okay.
Well, that's a good topic.
Yeah. That's like a breath of fresh air. Okay. And Roland. What is this section called? What'd you call it? I keep thinking picks.
Plugs.
Right now. Plugs, yeah. Okay, hold on. All right, we have some plugs today. Smuggler, would you like to fill us in on a couple of plugs you have?
Yeah, sure. Anaplex.net received a major redesign since the last episode, and we're actually doing a mirror for the Reality Exploit Roundtable podcast, which you can find at realityexploit.org. There you can find the last episodes as well. We don't have the show notes, but there's a second mirror for your consumption.
And Smuggler, if nobody tells you, I think the redesign on Anaplex is awesome.
Thank you so much.
Cool, great. And you can access that on anaplex.i2p, correct?
Yeah, anaplex.i2p, anaplex.net, and several Tor nodes that also point there. Just go to anaplex.net if you want to know all the addresses for the site.
Okay, great. Next, Voodoo. How about you?
Well, I have a deal where I want to collect a Yellow Pages directory of, agorist businesses, so that when I need whatever it is, I can vote with my money. So start at blackandyellowpages.com. It's a Yellow Pages directory. If you want a free listing for your agorist business on Black and Yellow Pages, just send me an email, voodoo@blackandyellowpages.com, and I will send you an invite. Free listings.
Great, thanks. Plato, you got anything to plug? Tell us about?
I recently renewed therealplato.com. There's nothing on there right now. Hopefully by the time you listen to this, they'll have thrown up some stuff. It'll probably just be some tech demos with that D3JS library I've talked about before, stuff like that. The only other thing I would say is go to grooveshark.com/therealplato, and you can take a look at the music I've been listening to lately, especially my trip-hop and chill playlists. And feel free to recommend me anything that you think I might like.
What was that domain again, the first part?
TheRealPlato.com and GrooveShark.com/TheRealPlato.
Oh, okay, GrooveShark, yeah, I didn't hear that. Okay, Wise Guy, anything you want to plug or recommend?
As usual, no.
Okay, great. And Agorist Radio, we've been moving our website and archives and things more deeper into the darknet and just serving with a gateway. We've had some outages and stuff like that, but things are back up. That's agorastradio.com. And when you can't reach us, always check out the links the Smuggler put up for the regular, a mere archive. And also for news, check out Orlin Grabe, orlingrabe.com for Bitcoin, privacy, science, tech, and a whole variety of stuff, news. It's a good site for cool stuff, I think. And let's move on to the our last topic. Recently, John Matonis in Forbes this past Sunday wrote an article called "The Cashless Utopia Mirage." And I'll just read a little snippet here, and then we'll get into the discussion. David Woolman's article, "The Anonymity Fantasy," gets off on the wrong foot by claiming to know what we all deserve or what we all want. As a reader, this is aggravating on multiple levels. But the pretentious fun doesn't stop there, as we later learned that anonymous cash does not equal freedom, and that, quote, clinging to cash is misguided. It could be cynical here, but I really don't think it's about perfidiously advancing a thesis to promote his new book. I think David actually believes all this despite what history teaches us. Let's not kid ourselves, because the end of money, as we know it, really means the beginning of the transactional surveillance state, which makes this a serious debate about the boundaries of state power and the dignity of the individual. Wise Guy?
Well, here. John is really right on the mark. I think when he takes the Wolfram article, a Woolman article, to task, is that a Woolman makes the point that anonymity and civil society don't mix. But John Matonis makes the point, and I think which is more important, is that it's the omnipotent, violent government and civil society that don't mix. So what's happening here is that if you are the kind of person who does everything according to how you, the government that you're so-called living under agrees with, and you don't stick up the old Japanese adage that the nail that sticks up gets hammered flat. If you don't stick up, you don't talk about anything that might make you a target or curious to your neighbors because your political views or whatever are different, then, of course, you don't worry about, for the most part, the government who regularly uses violence to suppress people with different thinking, you know, the political thinking. However, if you are an activist, or you blog regularly, if you buy food that's different than your neighbors, like raw milk, or you have other aspects of your life which don't fit in, well, then you're a target of the state, and then the need for transactional privacy becomes keen. For example, look what happened to under the Third Reich when people fled Nazi Germany. Well, if they didn't have the ability to take their money with them in the form of gold, if everything had been tracked by the government and everything was banking like it is today, where digital transfers are the norm, and physical currency or gold, my God, is highly unusual, none of that money would have been able to leave Germany. So I think in his article, he really says that it's okay to hold the view that anonymity, really doesn't exist and it's not important in a civil society. But that only works if you're totally invisible in that society and not important to anyone in government.
Yeah, you're hitting the main point here. If everybody is the same, then yes, you don't have to care about the government anymore, you know, because if you're believing in the mirage of democracy, then the government is you and you are the government and everybody is the same. And so it can only fight itself, and that we hope will never happen. But as you said, that's a fantasy. It's a mirage. It doesn't work like that, and we don't want it to work like that. I mean, we need diversity of opinion, we need diversity of lifestyle, and we cannot trust the tolerance of either the government or the rest of the collective to grant us the right to be in diversion from the main culture.
I happen to agree with you, Smuggler. I think we got to take our privacy into our own hands with our cash and our transactions as well as, you know, the rest of our lives. Wolman, Matonis is writing about his article. So Wolman disagrees with us, and he says the anonymity doesn't matter. The transactional privacy doesn't matter because government is good and it needs to have that information in order to fight crimes and stuff. And Matonis is disagreeing, and, you know, as with good reason, because it's another slippery slope. And if they can, you know, if you're using the government's digital cash, they can take their tax automatically out of every transaction, stuff like that. And I don't think that's a good thing.
I mean, I can understand from a, you know, a crime standpoint, a money laundering standpoint, why you would want to track every transaction. You know, but more for the Wayback Machine than for current events. You know, you don't you guys have really made me understand that the data collection is more for the Wayback Machine, so that once you do show up on the radar, we can go back in the database and see all your transactional history. And, oh, by the way, where did you show up with this extra $25,000 that we don't show you ever getting? I can understand that, but that just seems like such a low priority target. I don't. You know, this cashless thing seems almost like a fetish to me, almost like the real names. It's important for some reason that I don't quite get.
Because it's about morality. That's what it's about. It has to do with people having certain moral views that if they think they're in the majority, that they can force these down other people's throats. Because when you control people's money, you largely control their lives.
But they're not trying to force them down people's throats. They're using propaganda techniques to make people think it's sexy. Cashless society, like right there, that's saying, you know, it's the future. We're going to move beyond cash. We don't have to use this crappy paper anymore. We can do everything digitally.
I think there are many motives for a cashless society. And yes, the Wayback Machine and prosecution after the fact is part of it. Yes, it's part of it to condition the people and make them accept a tool of control. But I think there's a third point, especially when it comes to cashlessness. That is, economic transactions carry a lot of information that is useful for all kinds of things, predicting behavior, future behavior, predicting price behavior, and so on and so on. There are quite a large a group of people in government that believe that if we have enough data about the market, that we can simulate the market as successfully as the non-simulated market. And I think that especially bigger corporations and governments are actually trying to get control over all economic transactions so that they can successfully manipulate them without running into the same problems that the USSR did.
To me, it seems like the Wolman article is very similar to David Brin's thinking about the transparent society. That's sort of like even bigger view than the superset of what Wolman is saying. And the problem is that the people in power don't want this transparency for themselves. They only want the proles to have the transparency in their lives, but the people in power want to be able to shield themselves from any of those regulations.
There will be an asymmetry in the information as well. The government might be able to see all the records of the transactions for their government-run digital currency, but the traders and the people using the currency are probably not going to have the same level of access, and they're not going to be able to place the same bets that the government would.
Well, I think also the financial industry, the financial infrastructure, all the credit card companies, PayPal, all the banks, all of them, don't think that they're like towing the line of this Wolmeran guy having some type of moralistic viewpoint on this. All of those people would like nothing less than alternate means of transactions to be eliminated. Credit card companies push for one, what is the main thing that they push for, and that is don't use cash, don't use checks, don't use any other payment mechanism, use your credit card, use your ATM card, use all of these things. So that is another huge weight that is being pushed on, that these people, don't underestimate the push of the industry itself to move in this direction.
Yeah, let me amend what I just said. And I guess it wouldn't really be the state who's operating the currency. It's going to be the same type of partnership between the state and industry. They're going to license it out to, you know, Visa and MasterCard and split the profits.
Right. And the thing is that there are profits in non-cash transactions, while the same profits are not in cash transactions. If I pay somebody in cash, there is no transaction fee that I have to pay to a third party. The only transaction fee I pay is meeting with the person I'm paying. So that is the only additional cost that I have. And I think in a big way, this might become into a new scheme for getting money out of our hands to make profit and to control us.
Yeah, but see, that still seems like a real edge case to me. I mean, there's just not that many people in the world anymore who think that you can centrally plan an economy. It doesn't, you know. I mean, there's certainly plenty of people, but not so many influential people who actually believe that anymore. And I would actually kind of go against what Hiro just said and say that the banks aren't maybe not thinking that they're going to be right and virtuous, but cashless would be a way to make sure that everybody's money is in the bucket before we dump it this next time.
I'd like to chime in again on the people thinking that central planning is doable. There actually have been European Union funded projects to simulate the whole market based on nodes. So every market actor, every person in that simulation is actually covered for. But you can only do that if you have enough history on that person. And there's this big belief right now in the whole big data movement that if we just have enough data, we can run everything according to algorithm. And I think this plays in there. I do actually think that the powers that are there still believe that central planning is doable if you have enough data.
Well, you know, on the idea of, you know, what would be causing some of this push for the cashless thing, I think there's a similar analogy, and that is people talk about what caused the Iraq war, what is the push for regime change in a lot of these countries. And some people have this like grand theory that, oh, it's only about getting the oil, or it's about Israel, or it's about the overthrow.
Dollar hegemony.
Yeah, you got all, there's all these theories, and at first sometimes you can think, oh, that's the reason, but if you start looking into most of them, actually, there's something to all of them. There's something to even the one of the military-industrial complex, getting new contracts. And so when you have all of these interests that may be very small interests in and of themselves, a small part of the picture, but if they all have a cohesive ends, the ends actually benefits all of them in their particular goals, then you'll have 10% voting for their own reasons, and another 10% voting yes for their own reasons, and another 10 for their own reasons, and then it looks like some big conspiracy for a particular thing, when actually it was just so many interests that coincided
right
at the same time. And that's similar to some of the things we may be seeing in the financial world, that we think, oh, well, this is because of this, or this person's doing this, or there's one conspiracy here that they're really pushing for this, when really it actually may be just coalescing all of these different interests. And then,
right, that's a very good point you're making there. It's an aggregate of interests that usually pushes an agenda. And especially if you keep in mind that most people don't have any interest. They just follow whatever they're presented in the media and by their teachers and whatever. So you only need very few people that have a single interest, and then a lot of those single interests coming together, having the same means to different ends, and then you have the means.
Yeah, no discrete set of Baptists and bootleggers, or no identifiable discrete set.
One quick thing on this article. Can anyone tell me the significance of the two flies mating?
I was hoping one of you guys could tell us.
Well, I think that's actually a very good symbol for what Hero already said. You know, it's two interests coming together, fucking with each other to create new flies that will stick to the shit and eat it.
Wow.
Smuggler, you should interpret poetry or something. That was beautiful.
I have one more comment in the, about the article. That is, what do you call it? Matonis's article. And he closes with the fact that on the one hand, the people who are proposing this cashless society are saying that it will help, especially the people that are poor, that are unbanked. It'll make it much easier for them to have bank accounts, and you know, everything will be uniform. But in reality, cash isn't the enemy of the poor, and they're not hurt by the anonymity. In fact, they're the ones that desire it the most. The people we see in the informal, unlicensed economy, if it were true that this agenda of pushing for a everyone being banked and no informal economy, if it were true that the anonymity wasn't the friend of the poor, you wouldn't see the informal economy expanding as it is. It's actually not shrinking. It's actually expanding everywhere but in the few Western countries and major countries. So obviously the poor, they would be headed for the banks if it were really to their advantage. It's not just the cost of banking. It's the fact that they need to avoid the tax man because the taxation system is onerous for the poor much more than it is for even the middle class and the wealthy.
A good point.
One thing let me add in there about this whole topic is, like I pointed out earlier about, you know, what is online extremist, you know, radicalization. Some of these terms of language, I think that the term cashless society is actually a viral, almost Orwellian type. I don't know how to phrase it, but it's sort of a dangerous word because it's so ambiguous. Because when people think of like Plato, you were talking about, oh, it's sexy, it's digital, we don't have this dirty paper and everything. But the fact is that, you know, like cashless society, meaning like physical cash, you know, that can include Bitcoin, but or other forms of like open transactions, privately issued digital cash or something like that. There's that, it's really, that word really should, I mean, I would steer away from using that word and try to come up with another word which is more stigmatic to the what these people are actually talking about when they say a cashless society, because they're not necessarily talking about digital cash. They're talking about something else.
I think you just hit on the picture of the flies having sex. I think that's the visual representation of the word you're searching for.
There you go. All right, guys. Thank you, Voodoo, Smuggler, Plato, and Wise Guy. Good stuff. This has been episode 18, and we look forward to another episode coming up soon. And check our show notes out at agoristradio.com, episode 18, for links and notes to everything covered today.
Thanks, Hero.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thanks, Hero.
Thank you.